Many times I heard Swamiji say, quoting also Master Paramhansa Yogananda, that God doesn't mind our failings. The only thing he minds is our indifference. And I've read that, like many things on the spiritual path over many years, but I have to admit, I never really quite understood it. It's surprising how you can hear the same words and they don't really quite touch. And so I was reading today the parable of the prodigal son. I'm always really happy when we have the prodigal son. I like it much better than I come not to bring peace but a sword and separate man from his wife and daughter from her father and so on. That's kind of grim. This one is nicer, where this poor fellow has behaved very badly, but in the end all is forgiven and his return is celebrated. And reading that today, I actually finally understood what that phrase indifference means, which is what in the Festival of Light every week, and those of you who are new, you will hear it at the end today. It's the ritual ceremony that we do. But it starts at the beginning. There's an analogy, an allegory of a little bird traversing through the world, and that little bird represents the soul on its journey from creation to final God realization. And the first stage of that creation is that we are commissioned by the divine with a great opportunity. A mission is how it's described in the allegory, that we have been blessed by the presence of God within us. We have been blessed by the generosity of the Spirit in creating us and giving us the capacity to love. And our responsibility is to share that, to share everything beautiful that is within us with others, that they may be uplifted in the same way. But the way the allegory goes is the bird kind of gets out on its own, just like all of us can relate in human life. We're protected by our parents, and then we get out on our own. And oftentimes, parents are quite shocked when the child gets out on his own as to what he actually is interested in and what he will do when he's no longer so carefully supervised. I watch little children sometimes. I go to the YMCA for exercise, and there's a lot of parents and children there. And I mean, I know it's self-evident, and all of you who are parents or have ever been children, like me, children are really small, and they're quite helpless. You know, a parent can just pick up a small child, whether the child wants it or not, and the child gets hauled here and gets hauled there, and on a certain level, it's sort of nice, but on the other hand, you can see how it's quite annoying as a child to have so little opportunity to actually have freedom. It's also very, very secure. I remember as a child when we would get home from a long drive, if I pretended I was asleep, my daddy would carry me into the house. And I always remember pretending I was asleep because there was just something so comforting. My father was a big man and he would carry me into the house, and there's something so dear in that. But there's all sides of it. There's the helplessness, the protection, the lack of self-will, and then there's the opportunity to try it for ourselves, because we really don't know who we are as long as our behavior is confined. It's only when we actually have the freedom to choose that we find out what we're really made of. Swamiji sometimes made the joke that some people appear to be pious, but they just don't have the energy to sin, is how he put it. He said it's not that they're not inclined, they just lack courage and energy to do it. So that's not the same as actually being pure in heart. So we have this in the allegory. We have this mission from God to be fruitful in the gifts that God has given us and to share with others even as the divine has shared with us. But the little bird, as we say, begins to enjoy the freedom. And he begins to enjoy taking for himself and getting for himself and being important and having the power And after a while, it crosses his mind, this whole unselfishness wheeze is really, I mean, what is the point of it? The pleasure of life is getting for myself. And so we go into this whole middle stage that almost all of us are hopefully beginning to extricate ourselves from, in which we act according to what I think is good for me. And the problem is that our judgment is not always sound. And we tend to have a very short-term view. We have a short-term view of where our happiness comes from. We squander our health. We become addicted to things that are very bad for our bodies. We do things that are not good for our minds. We give in to our selfish emotions. We try to make ourselves feel good by having power over others. And in the allegory, it says that the bird clung to what he was doing, and this stage is called the revolt. I know that I'm a child of God. I know that my happiness lies in harmony, but now I'm going to rebel against it. Think about just human life. Someone is well brought up. Someone comes from a family where values are in place, but all of a sudden we get involved with other companions. We begin to drink, we begin to smoke, we begin to discover the pleasures of our body, we begin to become materialistic, and we revolt against the values that we know to be true. And then in the allegory of the little bird, even though repeatedly he lost everything he had, he still clings to the fact that he knows the best. And that's where a lot of us find ourselves these days. We're in revolt against what we know is true. But eventually, even the dullest minded among us begin to notice the pattern. And of course, this is a cycle of many incarnations. I remember speaking to Swami in my 20s when I first met him. And I remarked that I had always had this passion from a very young age that I really wanted to be happy. And it was odd, because I was. You know, my life was very privileged and very comfortable. I had a fine family, every opportunity in the world. But there was this underlying drive for happiness. Of course, I didn't understand until I became more sophisticated spiritually that what I was wanting was unconditioned bliss. Because a mere pleasant life, I could tell somehow that wasn't going to work out in the end. But I said to Swamiji, this is so odd to me. I have this passion for happiness and I've never been unhappy. And he looked at me, it was so obvious by that point. He said, past lives, past lives. I mean, look around us. How many people's lives start out well and end difficult? How many promising situations end tragically? How many even deep fulfillments when you finally have them just aren't quite enough? A teaching like self-realization really is not for people who are still striving for the basics, because there's still that belief that if, then I would be happy. A teaching like this is attractive for people who have the capacity to pretty much do whatever they want in the world, perhaps not become bazillionaires, but still to move through the world fairly effectively. But then we get this, we get that, we get this, we get that. And then we begin to realize it's just not enough. The heart is restless, St. Augustine said, until it finds its rest in God. So then we come to a point in our lives, and this is the allegory again, where we enter the stage called the quest. That's where I believe most of us live. We move between the revolt and the quest. And the quest is, what is the truth? How am I supposed to live? What am I supposed to do? And we start asking that question in relationship to a greater reality. You know, that greater reality, the simplest way to call it is God, but we can call it whatever we want. We start realizing that I move in this world in relation to a greater reality. In the story of the prodigal son, which is just a parable, the young man takes all the wealth of his father and he goes off. And he says, I'm going to enjoy myself in my way. And then it's a long, hard story of how it degenerates and degenerates and he squanders everything. It's that, what else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? And he's indifferent during that period of time, to his the labor of his father that gave him this wealth, the disappointment he is to his father, the needs of anyone else. He's indifferent to all of those things. All I want is what I can have for myself. But finally, he realizes repeatedly he lost everything he had, to put it in the language of the Festival of Light. This is just one lifetime in this parable. And he's literally, he's living on someone else's farm, taking care of the pigs. I mean, they really make the story like, ooh, you're just way down there taking care of the pigs. And the pigs are eating better than he is. And he says, what am I doing here? I'm the son of a wealthy man. I have a home. I have a place where I'm loved. I have a place where I'm comfortable and can have everything I want. So then he makes his way back. And all he wants now is even to just be a servant in his father's home. But of course, when he arrives, his father has loved him unconditionally throughout this time. And if we think of it as the Heavenly Father, our Divine Mother, has watched us struggle, has watched us fritter away our divine inheritance and lose everything we had repeatedly, and simply waits. Because no matter how we behave, that relationship can never be severed. The parable of the Father and the Son, or the deeper reality of our oneness with Spirit. As Swamiji also writes, there God is not far away. We turn our backs, but that doesn't mean that the divine is separated from us. But we become indifferent. We just don't care anymore about divine values. We don't care anymore about who we really are. So that is what makes it impossible for the divine to help us, because we don't care. We're not listening. The whisper of higher truths, the whisper of our relationship with a greater reality, we silence that with our selfishness. When we fail, when we strive for high ideals and collapse, when we become helplessly enmeshed in all of the temptations and weaknesses that are just rife with being a human being, but if we're not indifferent to higher realities, then God can continually help us. Do you see? So the prodigal son comes home, the father doesn't care at all. But when the prodigal son was not interested in the father, there was nothing at all he could do. So it's not like God minds when, you know, it's not like God doesn't care about our failures. The only tragedy for God is our indifference. Now, another thought related to this has come to me recently. We all know that we're living under the Chinese curse. The Chinese curse is, may you live in interesting times. And so we are definitely living in interesting times. The sort of comfortable expectations of what's going to happen next in the world are constantly being interrupted by political and violent events in the world. And now these maps that are coming out about how many continents are going to be underwater and how soon they're going to be underwater, and Venice is flooding. You know, it's just everywhere we turn. And here, we're just still enjoying this marvelous summer weather. And then it occurs to me that it's, you know, almost Thanksgiving. I mean, this is great on a real short-term basis, but it doesn't bode well. I remember saying to someone, it used to rain, you know. I did certain things because it used to rain. Oh yeah, that's right. If it really stops raining, like what will really happen? We really have no idea. All of these things are, and there's all these forces struggling against each other, and at least a person like me, I'm never quite sure where to put my energy. Now, Paramahansa Yogananda made predictions, and he made them very emphatically. He died in 1952, so now we're talking almost 70 years. But at the time, in 1952, Swami Kriyananda tells us that Yogananda spoke of tremendous changes coming to our society, to our world, that, you know, countries would shift and climates would shift and there would be economic troubles and wars and things like that. I mean, he wasn't a doomed teller. It wasn't like he was saying, you know, repent ye like that, the end of the world. It wasn't that at all. But he said certain karmic forces are at work, and we are shifting from a lower to a higher age, and that shift will be tumultuous. But, he said, the entire and only purpose of it is to awaken people to higher realities and to bring people to God. And so the result of it will be that many, many people will turn away from their indifference and will become interested in uniting with a higher reality. When I spoke to Swamiji about the advancing ages on the planet, we were talking about a time that none of us in these bodies are going to live to see. But he said, in higher ages, he said, people like us are in charge, which was kind of a nice idea, you know? He said, the whole world is like Ananda then, where people live as they ought to, with kindness and in relationship to higher values. So one conversation that I listened to between Swami Kriyananda and another Indian teacher named Sankeshav Das, who's now off the planet, but was a very elevated soul, and the two of them were talking about this understanding that times are changing and the shifts will not always be comfortable. You know, many parts of the world are already in states of great discomfort. It's just America itself is still secure. And you should hear, Master says America has very, very, very good karma. We have a little bad karma, he said, for the way we treated the Native Americans. And we built our wealth on their destruction. And he said, that's the karma that we're having to really work out. We will have to work out as a country. But but Sankeshav Das and Swamiji were talking. And they were talking about the fact, because Master talked about a time when there would really be a standoff between light and darkness, and that light would triumph, and America and India would be representing the light. I mean, these are very interesting prophecies, because you don't see how they're going to come about from here. But America and India would represent the light, and the light would triumph. But before that happened, Santji and Swami were talking, that the darkness will fight with itself. And it will fight with itself until it's weakened enough that the light and dark can confront each other and the light can triumph. Fascinating. Now, I've had that in my head for a very long time. And then recently, I saw it in a way that I hadn't seen it before, because many people are trying to find light and darkness in the political arena, or, you know, light and darkness in the climate change argument. All of the different ways in which the debate is happening presently. Because even when the debate is happening in religious terms, so to speak, it's happening in terms of religions. My dogma versus your dogma. My theology versus your theology. My absolute God's will versus your absolute God's will. But what we're actually seeing is we're seeing individual ego preferences playing themselves out. And the difficulty with almost all the solutions that are being proposed is that none of them are being acted out in relationship to a higher reality. None of them are being acted out in terms of we are all children of God. We are all equally loved by God. We have one responsibility in this world, which is to become perfect channels of that divine love and to love each other as brothers and sisters, not as my God says he should or your God says he should, or I want the rainforest and you want the palm oil from the forest, and I want the alligators and you want to get rid of the alligators, and, you know, I want the whales and you don't want the whales. But it's all different ego preferences. Can you hear that? I don't mean that nobody is inspired, but being in tune with the higher reality, even having the idea that there is a divine power, that we are all just players in God's dream, that it's not just what I want. What else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? And so it's difficult now, and oddly, as you may not like the sound of it, I think this is darkness fighting with itself. And I don't mean that somebody who's really concerned about the environment versus somebody who isn't, or somebody who's concerned about all the immigrants in the world versus someone who isn't. I'm not saying that there's not shades, many different shades. But the real issue is there a divine power? Are we loved by God? Are we all equal manifestations of God? When Swami was a very young man, just before he met Master, he tells the story about just thinking all the time, trying to find meaning in life, and going out one night, walking along the beach, and watching the ocean, the way the ocean was coming in, and the way the ocean was finding its way in all the little crevices. And he began to feel himself to be one with this infinite power. He saw the little self that he had always called himself to be just like one of those little threads of the ocean, just coming in like this, being withdrawn back, then coming in again. He saw himself as part of a greater reality. And he realized profoundly and deeply that as part of that greater reality, his only duty in life was to become a perfect expression of that. And he had not really thought in terms of God or spirituality or religion, but he experienced it within himself. And he saw that all of us are part of this greater reality. And that's when his mind, for the first time, really realized that the quest that he was on was a spiritual one. You see, God doesn't mind our failures. What he minds is our indifference. And what's happening on the planet now, even with very good intention, people are still moving from ego preference. And until we embrace, and this is what Master said the whole point is, until we embrace that we are all part of a greater reality, it'll be shades of darkness fighting with itself. But gradually, and alas, it's true, and here we are, the story of the prodigal son. He came back because he ran out of money. Right? If he'd had more money, he would have been comfortable and he wouldn't have come back. And that's, unfortunately, the way the human destiny seems to work. As long as we can have what we want, we think that's wisdom. And only when, repeatedly, we lose everything we have, whatever form that takes. And that also takes the form of just deep disappointment, meaning I have everything I want, but ego preference doesn't give me bliss. It's just as simple as that. There's more suicides among wealthy people than there are among poor people, because poor people can always hope that if I had that, I'll be happy. But once you have it, and you realize you're not, unless it turns you toward God, then there's no reason even to go on living. Isn't that so? You know? But, you know, Swami used to say, and it's become very meaningful to me, whenever he would see people suffering, he would always think, oh, how much greater then will be their joy when they finally turn to God. Because the contrast will make that all the sweeter. And I myself have begun to think of it that way whenever I see and have been exposed so many times to so much suffering in people's lives. I think, oh yeah, but this is the kind of suffering that makes people turn to God. So then, what is good and what is bad? What is even suffering? If the end of the whole story is that we realize that we are part of a greater reality. And everything we are seeking will be found when we attune ourselves with that. God doesn't mind how long we wait, doesn't matter how many times we fail, doesn't matter how pathetic we are, as long as we care. As long as some little part of us is asking, how can I be with you? How can I be your child? How can I return home to my true home in thee? God bless you.
soul of night has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. And lo, the hunter of the east has caught the Sultan's turret in Honduras of light.
Dreaming when dawn's left hand was in the sky, I heard a voice within the tavern cry, "Awake, my little ones, and fill the cup before life's liquor in its cup be dry."
The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, for it prospers and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two is
gone. Center through the seventh gate, I rose and on the throne of Saturn sate, and many knots unraveled by the road, but not the knot of human death and fate.
The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on, nor all thy piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it.
A moon of my delight, who knows no bane, the moon of heaven is rising once again. How oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me.